tuned.
Stay tuned.
To be continued.
Just pass next week. That's the
next week. There is Bizat Hashem, definitely class. All right, we've really just, even though we've had a couple of weeks of discussion related to this subject of Malchut Yisrael, we've really only begun to get our feet wet, if you will. We spent a good deal of time last shiur, I believe, talking about the conversation between Shmuel and the different groups that he's engaged in with in this parak. We talked about the fact that he is engaged in a conversation with the Zakenim, the elders, who are coming to Shmuel with a request for a king because they want some kind of different judicial system in place, that one that would be a little bit more independent of the influences of the people. And there's a second group referred to as the Am, or as the Chazal put it, the Amei Haaretz, sort of a more grassroots masses group, and they are looking for a king for a different reason, and that's essentially the message that we came away with. They're looking for a king because they want an army. We spent a good deal of time talking about the fact that the Mishpat HaMelech that Shmuel reads to them, lists for them, declares to them, is all about the power of the king to draft their sons, their daughters, the fields, to confiscate the money, etc., in order to create this army. And that's exactly what they said. They want an army. They want a large standing army. And that's why it's considered a rebellion. The last thing we talked about was a little bit of the spiritual dimension. Why is the establishment of an army considered an act of rebellion? That's sort of where we got into at the very end of this year. How is it that a request for an army is perceived both by Shmuel and in response by the Ribbono Shel Olam as a direct rebellion against God? It sounds fairly reasonable to assume that at some point or another you're going to have a malchus, you're going to have a country, you're going to need an army. To suggest that having an army is somehow anti-religious sounds almost like kind of after, you know, the army of the enemy is attacking, say go daven and say tehillah, right? But somewhere along the line somebody has to stand guard and somebody has to be your soldiers and somebody has to pick up the arms necessary to protect the people. So what is it about the request for a army that is at the core of the rebellion against God? That was sort of where we touched on it a little bit at the end of the end of Shir last week, and that's what I want to pick up today. We talk about the two examples from Sefer Shoftim, where we sort of begin to see the references to Malchus. There are two stories in Sefer Shoftim where Malchus becomes a centerpiece of, besides the end of Sefer Shoftim, where the Pesach Micham Pilagish Pagiva, there are two actual stories of Shoftim where the conversation around Malchus becomes a center point of the focus. One is Yiftach, and the other is Gidon. Talked about that?
We did, right. Yes. Yeah.
In both cases, there is a conversation about who is loyal to the army, who serves in the army, who comes to the campaign, who doesn't come to the campaign. Why didn't you call us to the campaign? If you remember Gidon, after the end of the campaign, the Bnei Ephraim come to him and they say, why didn't you call us? And Gidon has a very nice, polite answer. By Yiftach, Bnei Ephraim come to him at the end of the campaign, they say, why didn't you call us to help to help be part of your army? He says to them, remember what Yiftach says to Bnei Ephraim? Whatever it is, it's just before he kills 35,000 of them. Slaughters all of Bnei Ephraim. There's a sense of both by Yiftach and by Gidon that the absolute authority of the Shofet is unquestionable. And if you question the authority of the Shofet, that's tantamount to Mored B'Malchus, which is a death penalty of treason. both by Gideon and by Yiftach, they are very good at insisting on total loyalty. For very different reasons.
Is that always?
No, the other Shoftim, we never had that. That was unique to Gideon and to Yiftach, and it's part of the downfall of the Shofet, because in the context of a Shofet, that's exactly the key difference between a Shofet and a Melech, is in the ability to force conscription.
Oh, you said that.
Right? That's the key difference. A Melech can force conscription. That's one of the authorities of a king. A Shofet, by definition, cannot. We talked about Devorah. Devorah, who in her greatest moment, Devorah and Barak, the greatest moment where they call out to all the tribes, and half the tribes come and half the tribes don't, and she, at the end of the battle, has this lengthy shira where she talks about who comes and who doesn't come, because it's a volunteer army. So it's a volunteer militia who ended up coming. 10,000 soldiers from 5 tribes ended up answering the call. Gideon, it says, Vayitka b'shofar v'yiz'aka v'yezer acharav, he blew the shofar and they came running. 30,000 soldiers came. And then he said, okay, anybody who doesn't really want to be here, who's too afraid, go home. And 20,000 left. So why did they come in the first place? Because Gideon, as we know from the end of the story, if you say no to Gideon, you take your life into your hands. And so when he said, blew the shofar and 30,000 came, and then he said, okay, guys, I'll release you from the forced conscription. You don't have to be here. So 20,000 went home. But it's not an accident that immediately after the war, they come to Gideon and they say to him, Mishol banu gam ata gam mincha gam ben mincha, we want you to be our king. Rule over us, you, your sons, your grandsons, we want you to be our king. Because if you force conscription upon the people, then you've demonstrated that you're a king. If you kill the people of Pnuel and Sukkot because they said no to your request for quarter for your soldiers, then you've demonstrated that you've got the authority, the power, and the attitude of a king. You might as well take the crown and the inheritance and the dynasty and everything that comes with it. And not only that, at the end of the story of Gideon, we find 3 very interesting characteristics of Gideon that are unique. One is we have this description of the great power of his army, the breadth of his army, which we saw at the beginning. The other is, after the war with Midian, the description of his wealth and all of the money that he amasses from the spoils of war with the war with Gideon. Actually, you know, let's take a quick look at that because it's important. Shoftim Perek Chet. Shoftim Perek Chet, chapter 8. The end.
What pasuk?
That is a good question. Let's start from Pasuk Chav Bet, just because mention it, we might as well go back there a little bit. Vayomru ish Yisrael el Gideon, Mishol banu gam ata gam bincha gam ben bnecha. Rule over us, you, your son, your grandson. Ki hosha'atanu miyad Midian. You have saved us from the hands of Midian, which again goes back to that initial statement of he gathered together 30,000 people, and God said to him, no, you can't go to war with 30,000 because the people will say that you saved us and not God. That's not acceptable. V'yomar elhem Gideon, lo emshal ani b'chem, v'lo emshal b'ni b'chem, Hashem yimshal b'chem. Gideon's answer is a very classic theological statement. Namely?
Not me, it's God.
You don't need a king. God is your king. And that's exactly the statement that we need to understand, and I want to elaborate on today. Why is the assumption that a king is antithetical to faith in God? However, he says, "V'yomer alehem Gideon, eshela mikem sheila, utnu li'ish nezem shlalo, ki nizmei zahav lahem, ki yishmei limem." But Gideon said to them, "I want just have a small request, And that's a little bit of the spoils, a little bit of a tax, you know, gold jewelry. ויאמרו נתן ניתן ויפרסו את השמלה וישליחו שם איש נזם שללו ומשקל נזמי הזהב אשר שאל 1,700 זהב. He asked him just for a little bit of gold as a kind of a tribute, and they gave him their gold, and the result was 1,700 coins of gold. לבד מן הסערונים בנטיפות ובגדי הארגמן של מלכי מדיין ולבד מן הענקות אשר בצווארי גמליהם. And that's besides all of the other jewelry and clothes and precious articles that they took off the army of Midian. So what did he collect this all for? And here he says to them, you don't need me as a king. God is your king. But I wouldn't mind if you paid me for my efforts with a little bit of a tribute of gold. And they poured it on him. And so he took all this gold and all of these clothing and he turned it into an avodah zarah. He turned it into a monument to him in the form of an ephod, and he put it into his hometown in Ophra. Skip down to Pasuk Chav Tet. Vayelech Yerubal ben Yoash v'yeshu beveto u'legidon ayu shivim banim yotzei yirecho ki nashim rabot ayilo. He had 70 sons, Gidon, because he had many wives. Filakshoa asher bishchem, yalda lo gam hi ben. V'yasem et shmo avimelech. And he also had the Pilagesh, and the Pilagesh had a son, but then Avimelech, the rest of the story of Avimelech we're not going to read. But if you look at the three main characteristics of Gidon's story, which was the enormity of his army initially gathered at 30,000 before he let them go, because he forced them into it, the enormity of the wealth that he gathers after the battle, and the fact that he begins a pattern which other shoftim will model of many wives and many children, 70 children, and we see that pattern later on in other shoftim, for the purpose of putting these children into positions of leadership and authority over different cities in the area. And what emerges as the behavioral pattern of Gidon? These are the characteristics of Malchus. This is what a king does. A king amasses a lot of gold and silver, so he has a lot of power and a lot of money. He has lots of families and lots of wives and lots of marriages, so he can have lots of heirs to his throne and loyal servants to master over his kingdom. And he has an army that's based on conscription and therefore has a large army. It's precisely the characteristics of a melech, and those are precisely the three limitations that the Torah places on a melech, which we're going to talk about in a moment. And here's Gidon. No, I don't want to be a king, but I'll behave like a king. I'll do everything else like a king, but I won't take the crown. And in many ways, when we learned Sefer Shoftim, we talked about that being a moment of a tragedy, because it derails next generation into Avimelech, who's fighting for the crown, if you will, and the position of Melech, to the point where he does something else which kings in those days were known to do, which is execute all of the other competitive heirs to the throne so that he can maintain, so that he can gain power. Avimelech is very complicated, but this, you know, Shakespeare's written about these things. This is not Yesh Dvarim B'Go, as they say. This is a world history. We're supposed to learn from this is that there's a complexity to Malchus. There's a good side and there's a dangerous side. And you have to be careful, right? On the one side, you say, no, I don't want to take the crown. On the other hand, you do everything else as if you are the king and behave like a king, or behave like a king like all the other nations rather than a Jewish king, and you're begging for trouble.
So they were still scared of him, which is why they gave him all the money. They were still, the conscription and the money.
Attitude doesn't change.
Yeah.
Gideon is a very forceful. According to Tepnuel and Sukkot. And Yiftach learns from it. Yiftach is the next generation. Yiftach turns right, they turn to Yiftach and they say, Yiftach, why didn't you call us to your battle? And he says, okay, and he kills them all.
So is Gideon also considered flawed? Because I know Yiftach was.
That goes back to Sefer Shoftim. They're all, in a sense, flawed, right? There's also a certain degeneration.
No, but it's all Gideon's Bible. Is this the Gideon? The Gideon that you find in the hotel.
Can I delete that and roll that back?
I don't know. I've never looked at
it. That is a Christian Bible. It has nothing to do with
Gideonized.
We are.
Don't know where they got the name from, but that's. And they're the ones that put the Bible. No.
We're not going there. All right.
But you see them in the drawer.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not.
All right. Happy to know I never looked at
that. Now, let's. At this point, I think we need to go back to the Parsha of Melech in Chumash. Next time we need. Devarim Perek Yud Zayin.
Did we finish with Shoftim?
No, we finished with Shoftim for now.
Just for this.
For now. Yud Zayin.
Are we going back to Malach?
Shoftim is the foundation for everything, so we'll always come back to Shoftim. But yeah.
Yud Zayin.
Yud Zayin.
Okay. 17.
What pasuk? We'll get to it in a second. Parashat HaMelech begins in Pasuk Yudalad. We've read some of these psukim before, but I think we need to understand one particular part of this parasha. I want to understand in more detail. And that's the relationship between the Melech and the power of the army. Where are we at? Perek Yud Zayin,
Pasuk
Yud Dalet.
Right.
Got it. Psukim we've read before, we're going to read again, and then we're going to move forward. Ki tavo al aratz asher Hashem elokecha neten lach v'rishta v'yashavta ba, v'yamarta asim alay melech kachol hagoyim asher sevivotai. We've read this before, we've learned it, discussed it.
Yeah.
You come into the land, you've inherited it, you've conquered it, you've possessed it. You say you want a king like all the nations around you. Som tasim alecha melech asheivchar Hashem alekecha bo. You will appoint a king, God shall choose. Mikerev achecha tasim alecha melech from amongst your brethren. Lo tuchal letet alecha ish nochri asher lo achicha hu. You cannot appoint a king who is not of your brothers. That we've talked about as well. And that's those two psukim are the focus of the previous discussion we've had, which is there a mitzvah or isn't there a mitzvah? Is it optional or is it obligatory to appoint a king? Assuming, as we have up until this point, all along, that there is a mitzvah. Right? Assuming that there is a mitzvah mandate to appoint a king, the Torah then places specific limitations on the behavior of a Jewish king. In other words, if they started with the position of Asimalei Melech Kochol HaGoyim, we want a king like all the nations, Torah says you can have a king. You should have a king. You must have a king. But not necessarily Kochol HaGoyim. Not necessarily a king like other kings. Your king has to be different. Number one, Rak Le'arbelo Susim. Can't have too many horses. V'lo yeshiva ta'am mitzrayma leman harbot sus. That vav is complicated. And he shall not return the people to Mitzrayim in order to have more horses. So that he should not return his people to Mitzrayim in order to have too many horses. The vav there is somewhat complicated, but there's some relationship between the abundance of horses and Egypt. And returning to Egypt. Vashem amar lachem lo tosifun lashuv baderech hazeh od. God has commanded you not to return to Egypt, not to return to this path.
Is that adayam hazeh? You're not supposed to go back to Egypt?
So there's all discussion about the halacha. You're not allowed. There's all discussion what it means. You're not allowed to live in Egypt. You're not allowed to go to Egypt.
Nobody
you're not allowed
wants to go there now.
It's a this whole discussion, but that's brought down in the Rambam.
Yeah,
it's a complicated subject unto itself. Are you allowed to live in Egypt? Not allowed to live in Egypt. I'm not gonna. It's a complicated halachic conversation to itself. Are you allowed to live in Egypt? It's on the books. Velo yarbelo nashim. Number two, may not have many wives. Velo yasur levavo. Lest they lead your heart astray.
Of course.
Why would too many wives lead your heart astray? Biblically, remember, we're talking Tanakh terms, Chumash terms. Why would too many wives lead your heart astray?
Idolatry.
One second. One at a time. I can't hear in stereo.
Idolatry.
Idolatry. How does too many wives and idolatry
because
connect?
Chances are, well, at least with Shlomo, a lot of his wives brought their own idols.
Why does it go? Why is it assumed that many wives would bring about idolatry? Why is that an assumption?
Because the way it used to work is that you would marry different
from different countries,
women from different areas.
Because those women are foreign women,
right?
Because those women are foreign women. They are typically in the ancient world of monarchy, not so ancient. But in the world of monarchy, it typically was your multiple wives were not just to have many heirs, which was one part of it, like in case of Gidon, but also because it allowed you to enter into political marriages and allegiances and alliances, whatever they're called, with other nations, and hence other cultures that would come into your palace. Well, time permitting, I'll show you an interesting connection to this. The chesef v'zahav lo yarbe lamaod. Third limitation.
Not too much money.
But it doesn't define what's too much.
Right. Correct. And that's a major discussion. That's where the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Torah Shabbat Peh enter into the conversation. Okay, so let's put limitations. So let's put numbers to it. The Torah doesn't put numbers to it. Fair?
Yeah, I mean, today, two wives is too many. Yeah,
but for different reasons. Because today you're dealing with Yishuv polygamy. This is not about polygamy. That's a very important point. This is not about polygamy. Polygamy is permissible in the Torah. This is not about polygamy. This is about the nature of malchus. It's a very important distinction. V'aya kishivto kisei mamlachto v'chatav lo et mishnei Torah hazot al sefer milifnei ha'kohanim ha'leviyim. When he sits on his throne, he has to write a Sefer Torah, or Mishnah Torah. Vaitaimo, v'karabo, koi mechayav. He has to read it, he has to have it. L'man yilmad liyirat Hashem alokav, so he should learn to fear God. Lishmor et kol divrei Torah hazot, v'etuchokim me'ele la'asotam, to do all of the words of this Torah and their laws. Levilti rum levavo me'achav, in order that he should not become haughtier than his brothers. Ulevilti sur mina mitzvah yaminu small. In order that he shouldn't veer from the Torah right or left, that he should have length of days on the kingdom of, on the throne of Israel. So they're essentially in this passage limitations or restrictions or mitzvot for the king. There's a mitzvah on the people. There are four mitzvot essentially in this paragraph. One, on the people, to appoint a king, Sam Tasim Alech HaMelech. Four, on the king. Three of them, Lot Aseis, and one Aseh. The Aseh is that he has to write for himself a Sefer Torah, learn from it, read it, have it with him. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara that says that he actually has to have two, one that goes out with him and one that stays in his treasure house. But that's the Sefer Torah. And the other is the three mitzvot lo tasei. What are the three mitzvot lo tasei?
No horses, no Egypt.
Can't have too many horses.
Can't go to Egypt.
Can't have too many horses. Can't have too many wives.
And can't have too much money.
Egypt is a subset of the horses. So I'll leave that out for a moment. The three restrictions are... Lo yabelo susim, Lo yarbenu lo nashim, bechesef v'zahav lo yarbe lo mo'od. Those are the three restrictions. They're all material. They're all part of the wealth and the power of a king. Open parentheses. What are the three characteristics of Gidon at the end of the story? Right. What are the three characteristics that we just looked at in Gidon? Right. The money, the wives, and the size of his army. Right. The three characteristics that defined the story of Gidon were exactly these three. Not surprising, therefore, that they came to him and said, "Mishal banu." It's all there. This is what kings did. This is how kings operated. Right? This is what kings were. Now, in this story of Lo Yarbeh Lo Susim, the Kesef and the Nashim we'll talk about in a different context. But in this story specifically of Lo Yarbeh Lo Susim, there's a very interesting conversation in the Mefarshim. So, I'm going to pass this source page out, if you don't mind. Take a few moments. I want to look at this passage in particular.
Do wives matter where they come from? Do they have any more, anything that makes one higher than the next?
No.
Like whichever nation, whether they actually pay some of the
No. Not well. I mean,
it's all personal.
I don't want to get too much into that. The other dynamics of it are just not relevant to the issue of Sefer Shoftim, but Lo Yarbeh Lo Nashim was, that's what kings did. They had many wives. Only one wife was at any point in time was considered the primary wife, to who would give birth to the heir to the throne. The other wives were not.
And how was that?
Well,
by the king.
Sort of what
that's a choice of the king. That's when we get into David, we'll talk about that. It's much more relevant to the story of David than it is to Shmuel.
For a while.
We won't be there this year.
No, we won't be there this year. All right. Lo Yarbeh Lo Susim. So on this pasuk of Lo Yarbeh Lo Susim, there's a very interesting, I've divided this into two parts. You'll see why in a moment. Skip to the source 4, which is the Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin. Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin interprets this limitation in a unique way. Tanu Rabbanan, Lo Yarbeh Lo Susim, what does it mean he should not have too many horses for himself? Lo Yarbeh Lo Susim. Yachol afilu kedei merkavto ufarashav. Maybe it means that he can't have too many horses even for his chariots and horsemen and riders. Tamud lamar lo eino marbe. He can't have too many for him. Aval marbehu kedei rechbo ufarashav. He can have as many as he likes for his chariots and his horses. Susim. So why does it say that he susim in the plural? If it's only his horse, that's the issue. Susim habatlanin. It means horses that aren't being used. Horses for the sake of parading them through the baseball games. Right? Horses that are there to kind of ornamental.
No quad sales.
Demonstration of
for the king.
Demonstration of wealth and power and authority and symbol. That's not allowed. But functional horses for the purpose of having an army. Seems to be acceptable. Minayin shefilu sus echad v'u batel u'shu b'lo yarbeh. If he has even one horse that's not being used in a
military sense,
in a contextually mandated need, then it's permissible, that is prohibited. Tamud lamar leman harbot sus. Even one.
Wow, that's very strict.
So then why does it say in the plural? Right, there's two references to sus in this pasuk. Lo yarbeh lo susim, leman harbot sus. So there's a plural and a singular to tell us lavor belo tase al kol sus v'sus. Any extra horses needed violates the lo tase for each horse. So let's say you have an army of 100,000 chariots. You're allowed to have 100,000 horses.
Plus one.
But you're not allowed to have 100,001. Right. If you have 100,000,
the king can't have a horse to ride around, ride on.
Not unless it's in the context of warfare.
Okay.
And it's strange.
Yeah.
Now it's a strange interpretation, because what it means is that he can have as many horses as he wants for his army. And that seems to be the approach that many of the Mefarshim take. For example, source 3, which is there's a Targum on Chumash known as Targum Yonatan. There's a translation of it. Rak lo yarbelo al shnei susim. What is two horses? Shema irkavu sarav alehem v'yitga'u v'yitbatlu mitivrei Torah. Can't have extra horses, lest his riders, his officers, his sarim, they'll ride around on those horses, and they will take a position of haughtiness and arrogance. They'll be walking around, strutting through the city on their horses, kind of doing their thing. V'yitbatlu mitivrei Torah. Where in fact, what they should be doing is sitting in the Beis Medrash and studying Torah.
Well, how is the king supposed to get from the palace to the to the temple?
I guess if it's part of his merkava,
horse that he used for both.
Yeah, I guess so, but he can't.
He has to borrow.
It has to be in a context where it is a. It has to have a functional role. Can't be extra. In other words, according to this interpretation, which we're going to offer an alternative in a moment, but according to this interpretation, the prohibition of Loyabelo Sosim is very similar to a different prohibition in the same paragraph, namely Kesef Zahav. Right. In other words, it's part of his wealth, part of his grandeur and splendor, and he wants to show off. King can't show off. He has to be functional. He has to be limited to the role that he's mandated with. Part of that role is a military role, but that's it.
But he can have as many wives as he wants.
No, Leah Belo Nashim.
Yeah.
We already said that. That's exactly the. How many is? Yeah, that's a separate issue. I don't know why we get fixated on the wives. Leave the wives out of the picture for now. They're not relevant to us.
Horses, right? We know how many.
For right now, the wives are not part of the conversation.
Stick to the horses.
We'll get to the wives when we get to David and Malach. Not to worry. Rashi. Skip the Malbim for a moment. Rashi. Lo yabelo sasim. What is lo yabelo sasim? Can't have too many horses, says Rashi. Ella kedei merkavto. He can only have as many horses as he needs for his chariots. Shelo yeshiva ta'am mitzrayim. Now, let's go back to the second issue. Why does the Torah say you can't have too many horses so that you shouldn't return the people to Egypt? How do you get to Egypt? So Rashi explains, shasusim ba'im misham. Egypt was the source of the horse trade commerce of the world. Shasusim ba'im misham. K'moshin emar b'shlomo. And this is exactly what it says in the case of Shlomo HaMelech. In Shlomo HaMelech, it states explicitly, Vateitze merkava mitzrayim b'shesh miot kesef v'sus b'chamishim u'mea. That's exactly where he went to get the horses. Shlomo HaMelech had many horses. We'll see how many he had in a moment. And he and his horses were all purchased in Egypt. Or
how much they cost,
please. However much it costs. 600 kesef, or 150 kesef. Right, a chariot was 600, a sus was 150, whatever it was. The price is not the issue, but if you multiply that by how many horses you need, we'll see in Shlomo HaMelech's case how many horses he had to amass in order to gain that. Actually, you know what, let's look at that. Look here. Shlomo is famous because Shlomo violated every one of these three prohibitions. By Gideon, there's no melech, so it's hard to say he violated something which he's not a melech. He just pretended to be a melech.
Probably that's why I didn't want to be.
But by
too restrictive.
Yeah.
But by Shlomo was a king, and Shlomo is. Let's focus. Right? By Shlomo, he does do that. Malachim Aleph Perek Yud. Starting with in the end of the parak yud pasuk chavav. Vayesof Shlomo rechev ufarashim. Shlomo gathered together a multitude of horses and chariots. Vayilo elef ve'arbamiot rechev, 1,400 chariots. Ushnemesar elef parashim, 12,000 riders. Vayanechem ba'arei arechev ve'imamelech b'yushalayim. And he put them where? Where do you put that many horses and chariots? You put them in cities built specifically to house them. Arei arechev. Vayiten ha-melech atakesef b'yushalayim ka'avanim. There was so much gold, so much silver, so much money in Shlomo's kingdom that he lined the streets of Yushalayim like stones. Ve'atarazim natan kishikim asher b'shvila l'rov. Where did he get all these horses? Umotza susim asher lishlomo mimitzrayim. Where did he gather his horses from? From Mitzrayim. Umikves sochrei hamelech yikum mikvem v'mechir. And they went down and they gathered together all his officers, all of his salespeople gathered down in Mitzrayim. Vatale vatetze merkava mimitzrayim v'shesh minot kesef v'sus v'chamishim u'meyah. And they would negotiate. They got a chariot for 600 silver and a horse for 150. Mitzrayim was the source of horses not only for Israel, but for all the kings of Chittim and all the kings of Aram. They were the center of the horse trade. So, Shlomo Melech, the description of the end of Shlomo Melech's kingdom is very much a description of his gathered a mass of horses, a mass of gold and silver, and I'll just opening four or five words of the next parak, V'hamelech Shlomo ahav nashim nochriot rabot, and many wives.
Right.
So Shlomo was indeed in violation of each one of these three commandments. We'll talk about that at length, Bezrat Hashem, at a future time. But that's the. But what's interesting here is that in the halachic description of the horses, there's a problem. Because it would seem that what Shlomo did was not necessarily prohibited. With the wives, yes. With the money, yes. With the horses, at least the way the Gemara seems to read, not necessarily prohibited, because they were all part of the army. So there's a problem. You understand. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip. There's a whole bunch of additional interpretations. Rashi, Rabbeinu Bachaye, Ketav HaKabbalah, they all basically say the same thing, that the horses and chariots for the amass of an army is permissible, but for personal grandeur, splendor, is prohibited. However, I would argue that from a perspective of the pshat of the story, and the pshat of the parak, when the Torah says lo yabelo susim, that's not what it means. When the Torah says lo yabelo susim, it doesn't mean you can have as many horses as you want for as large an army as you want, but you can't have a single horse whose purpose it is to march down the streets and wave to the people. I don't think that's the pshat of the parak. Take a look at the Ramban. I think the Ramban hit the nail on the head in this case, in terms of at least the pshat. Says the Ramban, Kshali Bazeh is challenging Rashi's interpretation of not coming back to Mitzrayim. You're not allowed to live in Egypt, but you're allowed to engage in commerce in Egypt. That's a Yerushalmi. So to suggest that the reason why the Torah prohibits horses is so that you shouldn't have too much commerce with Egypt doesn't make sense. ואם ישלח המלך ויקנה משם הסוסים והרכב סחורהו מותר. If you're just going to buy the horses, then that's business. That's permissible. ויתכן שדרך הכתוב כי הזהיר לו יבל הסוסים. It could be that the understanding of the text is that the prohibition of not having too many horses afilu me'arzo, even if they're from Israel, from his own land, or even if it's in some permissible fashion. Why can't he have too many horses? Let's listen to the Ramban's understanding. Shelo yiftach al richbo ki rav ve'al parashav ki atzmu od. So that he should, as king, as general, as leader of the army, should not rely on chariots in their multitude, and on horses in their strength, aval yem miftacho l'shem elokav, but it rather his trust should be in God. In other words, according to the Ramban, the prohibition of Layabela Susim is not that he can have as many horses as he wants for his army, but he just can't have a single horse for his own splendor. Rather, the prohibition is can't have an army built on horses and chariots. His army has to be limited in scope, in weaponry, in style. Lo yiftach al richbo ki rav al parashav ki yatzmu ma'od. And therefore, a king was not allowed to have too many horses, an army built around horses and chariots. The modern equivalent would be, you can't have
too many tanks,
too many planes. Can't build an army of tanks and planes. A few, if you need them, but not too many. What's too many is a good question. But you have to have an army built on foot soldiers. Are your enemy has horses and chariots, and your enemies have tanks and planes? Eile v'rechev, ve'eile basusim, ve'anachno, v'shem v'shem l'kenu nizgir. They can have horses and chariots, we have our soldiers, and we trust in God. And we can be vastly outnumbered and outgunned, and that's the way the Torah wants it. Why? Because then you're forced to rely on God.
But you're going to think of modern Israel.
Yeah. That is correct. And that's exactly what the Torah says. That is in direct violation of the theme of the purpose of Malchus is. Why do the people want a king? This is the core of the issue. Why do they want a king?
So they don't have to rely on God.
They want a big army. And what do you gain when you get a big army? What do you achieve? Why wasn't the militia, the call it militias of volunteer militias of Ehud and Barak and Devorah and Otniel ben Knaz and every other shofet in the story of Sefer Shoftim, why were they insufficient? What do you need an army for? You saw the Nachash in the army of Ammon is coming, is marching on your borders, and you wanted an army, and you wanted a king. And the king is going to conscript your children, and you said yes. And the king is going to violate every ounce of justice left in the country by taking your fields and your lands and your money, and you said yes. Why would you be willing to subject yourself to the slavery of a king? Because you want an army. Because in your minds, what does an army do?
Security.
It frees you from your dependence on God. This is the core of the issue. If there's any message to Sefer Shoftim, it's that we can be vastly outgunned and outnumbered, and we'll still be victorious because we'll have to be loyal to God, and God will protect us. When Gideon amassed his 30,000 soldiers against an army of Midian, now remember, the army of Midian is horses and camels and soldiers like locusts Sorry, I said we were finished with Shaftim. Let's go back to Shaftim.
Shaftim is safe and not Shaftim.
Safe, Shaftim is safe. Correct. I don't usually identify Chumash sources by Parsha. I usually identify them by Perek. For that reason. It's a Sefer Shoftim, Gidon is Perek Vav. Beginning of Perek Vav. Chapter 6. Pasuk Hey, 5. Ki, Hem. It's talking about the enemy, the army of Midian. Hem, Umiknehem, Ya'alu. The Oalehem, Ya'uvau Kede Arbel Larov. They came like locusts, swarming through the land. Velehem Beligmalehem in Mispar, on camels, without limitation. Ve'avo Be'aretz L'Shachata. And they came swarming over the land, and destroyed the land. This was the army that they were dealing with. So Gidon, and he masses his army, he pulls together 30,000, correct? 32,000. Take a look now in Perek Zion. Vayomer Hashem al Gidon, Pasuk Bet. Vayomer Hashem al Gidon. Remember, he gathered together. He called. He blew a shofar, and they came. We don't yet know how many came, but they came. Vayomer Hashem al Gidon, Rav Ha'am Asher Itach. You have too many. I'm not letting you go into war with this many. Why? Mititit mitiyam biyadam. You have too many. Why? Pen yitpa'er ala Yisrael emor, yedi oshieli. Lest you're victorious. You will be victorious. But in the end, if you're victorious with this many soldiers, what are you going to say?
It's the soldiers, not Hashem.
Yedi oshieli, I did it. Ve'atak krana bozneh am lemor mi'arev v'charev v'yashov v'yitzpor mehar gilad. So now go and tell the people, whoever's too afraid to be in this battle, should go home. Ve'yashav min'am eslim v'shnaim elef, 22,000 left. And he was left with 10,000. The Yomer Hashem al Gidon, Oda Amrav. There's still too many. Take them down to the water, and I will forge them. I will separate them. I will select from them. And of those 10,000, who got left? 300. And those 300, he went to war with Midian. Then the rest of the army joined later. But with those 300, he broke the ranks of Midian. That's Loya Belosusi. That's precisely the message that the Rebbeinu Shlomo wants to convey. You're right. In the modern army, we wouldn't tolerate that, but only because we lack that kind of emunah. This is exactly the issue. This is why it's so difficult. Because that's exactly what the Torah says. You can have an army. You want a king? Isn't it? But don't think you can have a king because you're going to have a standing army and now the army is going to protect you. Ultimately, the only protection you have, the real protection you have, is from the Rabbanu Shlomo. And if you place your confidence in the army of flesh and blood, that means that you're lacking in your faith in the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Not true. There's a balance. And some chen olanes, right? So you're not going to sit in the Beis Medrash and say, okay, well, we don't need any soldiers. There's a balance. But that's exactly the Torah's balance. So you want a melech kusim teid. You want soldiers kusim teid. But your soldiers are going to stand there with guns and not horses and chariots. Torah states you can have soldiers, but not horses and chariots. And when the kings violated that, they were in trouble. That's exactly it's a very difficult balance. It's a balance which is a constant give and take. That's why you needed Nevi'im, that's why you needed back and forth. It's not an easy balance. Nobody ever said it was. But that's exactly why the Torah says you want a king, but not kechol hagoyim. This isn't about building an army that allows you the luxury of severing your dependence upon God, because now, Michamocha Ba'alim Hashem, right? Now you can say, what's the famous debate of the Hanukkah song? You know the famous song, Hanukkah song, Mi Yimalel Gvorot Yisrael. The original words were Mi Yimalel Gvorot Hashem. Mi Chamocha Ba'alim Hashem. There's a huge debate in the culture of Israel as to whether or not that song should be Mi Yimalel Gvorot Yisrael or Mi Yimalel Gvorot Hashem. Because that's exactly it. We were victorious. What did they say to Gideon even after he went to war with 300? And even, right, then he brought together Bnei Ephraim and they continued the battle and they had tens of thousands who came and joined him afterwards. And when it was all done, what did they say to Gideon? Mishol banu gam bincha gam ben bincha gam bincha gam ben benecha. We want you to rule over us. Why? We read it just a minute ago. Because you saved us from the hands of Midian. That's the problem. That's the problem. That's the problem we had in the Six Day War in 1967, when, against all the odds, when we were victorious, and the arrogance and that came out of that battle. According to many military assessments, it was that arrogance that ultimately led to the Yom Kippur War. There's a certain danger in over-reliance on the military strength that allows us the perceived luxury of saying we don't have to rely on God. That's the danger. And it's a very difficult balance. That's what the Nevi'im and the kings are constantly battling over. If there was a theme to the story of Tanakh post the establishment of Malchus and the dynamic between the Melech and the Navi, it's over this issue. Your reliance on God and not on your own power, money, and military strength. And the king who managed to strike that balance best were two. But the one who managed to strike that balance best was the greatest warrior in Jewish history. David HaMelech. Who did not have horses, and who did not have chariots, and who did not have all of the trappings of, but he had an enormous sized army. We'll talk about that when we get, and the in the one very small moment of weakness when he went to count the size of his army and to gloat in the size of his army, he was punished for. That's the difficult balance. And I think that's where the Ramban puts his finger on the issue here in this pasuk. It's not about he can have as many horses as he wants for his army, but he just can't have one to gloat on. It's about you can't have horses, you can't build your army based on horses because it's too powerful a reliance on your own strength and not doesn't leave enough room to be forced to rely on God. You want a king? That's fine. You want an army? That's fine. But don't think we're going to relinquish you from the responsibility of Sefer Shoftim. That's the key. And I put at the end of this source page three sources from the Nevi'im. One in particular, it's worth looking at inside, and that's the beginning of Sefer Yeshayahu.
Certain rules. You have to do what the Torah says. And does that leave your judgment out?
What do you mean by your judgment?
You mean the king's judgment?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, isn't it
leave it out. I mean, but it is limited. It's like a constitutional monarchy. A constitutional monarchy means a king doesn't have absolute power. He has to follow rules. The Jewish king has to follow more rules.
So what's right? where do you stop being the guy
who refuses the rowboat and the helicopter to rescue him from the flood, right. And then God says, "Who do you think sent that?"
It's a very difficult balance. Typically, that was the role of the Navi. But it's a difficult balance. But the way the Torah presents it is soldiers, yes, tanks, no. Soldiers, yes, chariots and horses, no.
What about Iron Dome?
Yeah. That's exactly what I'm sitting here.
But again,
thinking.
In the modern context, there's a point at which there is a certain challenge to our emunah in the sense that we rely too much on our own hands and not enough. I think that there's a today's context. I think the level of emunah that we have is actually significantly less than the level of emunah that the Torah demanded of us. So we're working our way up the ladder. You're right.
That's interesting.
You're right. It's a very difficult balance.
But there are examples. I mean, there a story came out from this summer about. Do you want to turn it off? Or do you want me to go through?
Yeah, it's okay.
Story came out this summer. I mean, it was throughout Israel that there was a soldier who wasn't observant at all and called a rabbi and said, "I want to learn." And the rabbi asked him why, and he said, "You know, I was manning the Iron Dome, and it looked like something was going to be hit, and all of a sudden, the wind changed. It wasn't hit." So, and this was a person who now had phenomenal. I mean, he
correct.
Realized
I'm not,
it wasn't
I,
him; it
again,
was God.
Again, one has to be very careful. Right? I'm not necessarily suggesting we go dismantle the Israeli army, but understand that there is a balance here. It sounds like there's a certain limit that we have to be exceptionally careful and. You build an army that allows you to rely too much on your own strength. It develops an arrogance that is complicated and problematic.
Yeah. Because we don't have anybody to help us decide.
Correct. So in the absence of a Navi, we grapple in the dark. Correct. But that's exactly the problem. I'm not necessarily advocating anything, but this is exactly what the Tanakh challenges us.
But Snaf always has this idea that you have to be part of the solution. You can't just solely depend on the
solution. Within limitations, correct. Because the limitations of Malchus are the other extreme. The issue of Malchus is the other extreme, right? You have a melech, you have an army, I don't need God. And that's exactly what the Torah says. No. After you finish conquering the land of Israel, you want to establish a Malchus Kuzendait. After you've, right? You don't need it. This is exactly the challenge. It is. It's exactly the problem. And we think living by the laws of the Torah and the ideals of the Torah is easy, right? You keep Shabbos, you keep kosher, right? It's easy. Today in Eretz Yisrael, it's so easy to be a religious Jew. No. Even Israel or Chutzlaretz, it's not easy at all. We think it's what? It's Shabbos and kashrus and you daven three times a day, and you're a religious Jew. The context of the dynamic, the religious persona, the notion, the relationship with God, and the constant awareness of the level of emunah that you have to have is enormous, and a constant challenge. And this is what the Torah sets out. Not an easy balance. In fact, I would say, in the history of Tanakh, we probably violated it more than we lived up to it.
Probably.
And that's part of the issue. So let's take a look at Yeshayahu.
It's depressing.
It's, I've always said, Tanakh isn't a happy-go-lucky text, right? It's a challenging text, because it's...
You're not reading the Wizard of Oz.
Because we're still here.
I think you're more patient than I am. Before we look at Yeshayahu Perek Bet, just look on the page, sources 11 and 12, two examples of how you see the Nevi'im understood this phrase of Lo Yabelo Susim, not that too many horses. Look at Yeshayahu. Hoy Hayordim Mitzrayim Le'ezra. Woe unto those who go down to Egypt for help. Al Susim Yeshayenu. They say we will rely on horses. V'yiftachu al recha v'kira v'al parashim ki atzmu ma'od. That's the phrase that the Ramban paraphrased in this discussion. They rely on horses and chariots, and they're many and in their strength. V'lo sha'u al kadosh Yisrael v'et Hashem lo darashu. They did not rely on God and did not seek God. Or Hosea, Ashur lo yoshienu al sus lo nirkav. Don't rely. Ashur is not going to save us. On horses, we're not going to ride. This is the mindset of the Nevi'im. The Nevi'im struggled with this issue all the time. This was their issue, that the people were relying on their power of their strength. In those days, it was horses and chariots. Today's day, it would be something else. To the sacrifice of their commitment to God. And that's what the Nevi'im complained about. Take a look at source. 1 minute left. Take a look at Yeshayahu Perek Bet. And this is we're going to start from this Perek Bezrat Hashem next week. But I want to show you the last piece of this. Perek Bet, very famous Nevuah. Hadavar asher chazay Yeshayahu ben Amoz al Yudah v'Yushalayim. V'ayah b'acharit hayamim. It will be in the, just typically translated as the ending of days. I don't believe it translates like that. I think it translates better as it will be in the future days, sometime in the future. Everybody have it? Yeshayahu Perek Bet? Nachon yiye ha bet Hashem berosh ha'arim b'nisa mikvaot v'naru elav kol ha'goyim. The temple, the Beit Hashem, will be elevated amongst all of the hills, and all of the nations will flow there. The nations will say, let us go to the house of God, who will instruct us, teach us, we will walk in his ways. It will judge between nations, and he will chastise many nations. Beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning forks. Very famous vision of Yeshayahu. Now it goes further. Beit Yaakov, lechu v'nacha ba'or Hashem. Beit Yaakov, let us go up in the light of God. Open parentheses, Beit Yaakov Lechu V'Nelcha became the acronym of a very famous Zionist youth movement called Bilu. Beit Yaakov Lechu V'Nelcha, Aliyah. They simply left out the last two words of the Pasuk, which is Be'or Hashem. It was a socialist movement. They did not believe in Be'or Hashem. Ki natashta amcha Beit Yaakov ki mal'u mikedem v'onanim kaplishtim. You have abandoned your people, Yaakov, because they have filled their land with soothsayers and astronomers and idolaters, ubialdei nochrim yaspiku, and they clap with the children of Gentiles, and they violate all of the Torah's prohibitions. Vatimalei arzo kesef zahav. They fill their land with gold and silver. Ve'en ketzel otzrotav, without limitation to their gold, to their wealth. Vatimalei arzo susim ve'en ketzel markvotav. They fill their land with horses without limitation to their horses. Vatimalei arzo, what's the third prohibition of kings? Can't have much money and gold. You can't have too many horses. And what's the third? Can't have too many wives. Look what Yeshayahu does with it. Vatimalei arzo elilim. Fill their land with idolatry. So you had kings who were arrogant enough to violate every one of these limitations on the king, and to fill their land with wealth, to fill their land with horses and chariots and power of military strength, not to mention the cultural affliction of Avodah Zarah. Therefore, Vayishach Adam, Vayishpal Ish, Vayalti Salehem. God will lower man, lower the arrogance of man. בו בצור והתאמן באפר, מפני פחד השם מהדר גאונו, they will hide in the rocks and bury themselves in the dust out of fear for God and the greatness of his majesty. Enei gavut adam shafel, the arrogant eyes of man shall be low, made low, v'shachrum anashim, and the haughtiness of man shall be lowered. Take the kings in all of their arrogant splendor and wealth and lower them into the dust. And who emerges? V'nisgav Hashem levado v'yamo. That's Yeshayahu's response to the kings who constantly violated the arrogance of Kesed, of Loya Belasusi. The reliance on the strength of their own hands and the arrogance of, this is my kingdom and I will protect it. To be continued.
Yes.
We still don't know how much.